Arthur Mann, Mutual's American Warfront correspondent, is in London tonight. He will report from that city first-hand observations of activities on the Western Front. At this time, reports from Europe are subject to censorship at the point of origin. We take you now to London.
Good evening. It is a little sad tonight to be broadcasting to you at home, who have been celebrating American Independence Day. It is a little sad because for the first time for many years, we Americans in London have not held any communal celebration of what we were used to make a joyful occasion. It was decided that the situation here is too stern and too critical for any lighthearted festivities. It may, in fact, be the last 4th of July, which will be within the ken of some of the few Americans who are still left in Britain. On the other hand, perhaps it was a mistake not to have celebrated Independence Day. For Great Britain is now engaged in the final stage of her own struggle for independence. She has even unconsciously adopted some of the technique of the American revolutionists. We had our Minutemen, those volunteer soldier irregulars, armed to defend their homes and their neighborhood from enemy attack. Today we have here their equivalent in this besieged Britain, the local defense volunteers, an organization which has been formed throughout the country on the same lines and for the same purpose. They are part of this island's home defense system. Daily, the ever-present fact of this land as a besieged country becomes more and more impressed upon the dwellers within its shores. Residential travel and holiday restrictions and the constant German air raids are a continual reminder. The character of these raids, incidentally, remains a puzzle to a good many of us. In the main, they seem still to be confined to attempts on military objectives, harbors, docks, airdromes, and industrial plants. I say attempts because the British defense of searchlights, anti-aircraft guns, and fighter planes frequently cause the German raiders to dump their bombs anywhere in order to lighten their planes and get away. But in numbers of planes involved, there is some ground for the belief that these raids so far have been of an exploratory and reconnaissance character. It looks as though the German high command may have been merely peeling out the defense system of Great Britain, trying to locate future objectives and possibly training future leaders of much larger scale raids before embarking on a mass air attack or air invasion of this country. There are two schools of opinion here concerning Germany's forthcoming strategy regarding the expected attack on the British Isles. One group believes that there will be tremendous air raids with high explosive and incendiary bombs on this country, coupled with attempts to land by parachute and from troop carrying planes, and also on the coast from seaborne vessels. The other group thinks that the Nazi military leaders will pursue a less direct and more roundabout method of attacking the center of the British Commonwealth of Nations and the seat of British sea power. They believe that the Germans will first attack Britain's position in the Mediterranean in conjunction with the Italian forces. The Germans and the Italians, they argue, will try to take Gibraltar, Malta, and the other British naval ports and stations in the Mediterranean basin in an attempt to further isolate Great Britain from her dominion and colonial sources of supply. Whether or not French Mediterranean colonial territory would come within the scope of such action is not so certain, but it might well do so on the basis that Hitler may feel obligated to help Italy satisfy her Mediterranean territorial ambition and thus keep that Axis partner sweet. If and when such a Mediterranean campaign was successful, according to this school of thought, Germany would then turn her air and military might directly on Great Britain. But this period of speculation and uncertainty is not likely to last long. The German technique of the Blitzkrieg is not apt to permit of much delay. There is certainly no official expectation here that this country will have to wait long for Germany's next move, and the government's defense preparations have been made on that basis. At least one thing has been learned and digested from the German Blitzkrieg in Belgium and France. Regulations restricting residence, holiday movements, and weekend travel have been designed partly with the object of doing all that is possible in advance to keep civilians and non-essential persons off the road at a time of crisis. No refugee columns are wanted here. Britain's increasing defense preparations are taking place also in a less spectacular sphere than the military one. Finances are playing an equally important part in this struggle for survival. In order to encourage the public's investment of savings in war loans and to conserve raw material, labor, and factoring resources, The government has already cut down the amount of consumer goods on the retail market by about 50% for a wide range of articles of all kinds. Now it is proposing to place a sales tax on goods which would further limit the public's buying capacity. Some mercantile circles expect this tax to amount to as much as 25%. On the other hand, the government is being equally active in encouraging Britain's export trade, particularly to the United States and to South America, in order to obtain foreign exchange with which to help finance our huge purchases of war supplies and raw materials abroad. More and more is the war effort taking on the pattern of a totalitarian. In this connection, I heard today of a piece of forthcoming government action which shows British Labour's determination to make sacrifices for the cause of victory. With the full approval and concurrence of the Labour ministers and the Labour Party and trade union leaders, the government, according to my informant, will shortly pass into law an act setting up a National Industrial Arbitration Council, whose decision will be binding. This council will adjudicate on all industrial disputes which cannot otherwise be settled. This means, in effect, compulsory arbitration, a principle which British Labour and British trade unions have hitherto absolutely refused to accept. Its forthcoming acceptance, for the duration of the war only, it should be added, means that British Labour has now decided that the war effort must not be slowed down by strikes. Meanwhile, Great Britain appears to have good reason to be satisfied with the results so far of her air offensive against Germany and German-occupied territory. Air Marshal Sir Philip Gilbert, a member of the British Air Staff, in a broadcast talk here tonight, revealed some features of these attacks which were not generally appreciated here, though they naturally were by the Germans. In the last 49 days, the British bombers raided Germany on 36 nights. During that time, there were only 13 German air raids on Great Britain. The British night bombers had, in addition, taken on more than their specifically allotted job when over the Third Reich. They have a habit of looking around for an extra bit of work to do. One of their stunts is to attack German planes which may be practicing night landings on their home airdromes. One British squadron, during recent nights, said Sir Philip, destroyed four German planes, so engaged. Intelligence reports, he indicated, show that the British bombing raids have had a very considerable effect on Germany's industrial and transport system. The supply of German forces in Belgium and northern France is reported to have been greatly interrupted by the British bombing of railway lines. Without wanting to exaggerate the damage so far done, Sir Philip emphasized that all signs show that this pressure, if maintained, may, in the long run, contribute effectively to the winning of the war. The problem, therefore, he concluded, is to maintain Great Britain as a secure base from which to develop her offensive, at first mainly by sea and air, and later perhaps on land, against the German military organization. The big news here tonight, of course, as you have already heard, was the announcement by Prime Minister Winston Churchill and A.V. Alexander, First Lord of the Admiralty, that a large part of the French fleet is safely in British hands. But there will probably be no more terrible drama in this whole war, however long it lasts, than that tragic but necessary sinking of the pink squadron at Oran. That act was the epitaph of the Anglo-French alliance. Now Britain truly fights alone. Thank you and good night.
We return you to a mutual broadcasting system in New York.
Arthur Mann, Mutual's American Warfront correspondent, has reported direct from London first-hand observations of activities on the Western Front. Now, by transcription, the orchestra plays the scherzo from the third movement of Midsummer Night's Dream.
Thank you.
Dream. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.